ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
It's undeniable that the visit of Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi to Australia has made waves, particularly his sold-out stadium spectacular in Sydney last night. Meanwhile, a very different sort of spectacle is gripping Pakistan, where the former Prime Minister and cricket star Imran Khan is facing what he says amounts to nearly 150 legal cases against him. In the course of the last few weeks, he's been both arrested and released, while his supporters have taken on the country's powerful military in a series of protests. Dia Hadid is an international correspondent covering Pakistan and Afghanistan for NPR News, and she's based in Islamabad. Thanks for joining us for our fortnightly Asia update, Dia.
You're welcome, Sarah. Hello.
Hello. Can you start by telling us about the current crackdown that's happening? You say it's quite dramatic right now.
Yeah, it seems to play out every evening with a new twist and turn, and Pakistanis are quite gripped by it. The Pakistani security forces have been detaining thousands of supporters of the former Prime Minister, Imran Khan, and they include some of his top aides. Some of them have been detained, released, only to be snatched away again at the steps of courthouses, bundled off to be detained again. And last night, one of Pakistan's most prominent women, one of Khan's most senior aides, a woman called Shireen Mazari, announced that she was leaving politics because she was concerned about the safety of her daughter and mother. And that was after she was detained and released in sort of a back-to-back cycle four or five times. And these sort of denouncements on TV have become a part of the crackdown itself. Former aides to Imran Khan will get on TV or hold a press conference and say they no longer support the party, that they're distancing themselves. And the party says this is happening under duress. Certainly, Shireen Mazari's announcement yesterday appeared to be a blow to Imran Khan himself. She's quite a senior leader and really occupied a very prominent place in Pakistani political life. She was the former human rights minister who went to war with human rights organisations, was famous for her coloured hair that seemed to reflect her mood sometimes. It could be anything from moody blue to a shocking green.
Bit of a tell, yeah, for a politician, I would have thought.
She was a character. She was a secular hardline hawk who didn't like foreign journalists and yet was tasked with being the international media advisor. But she was a part of Pakistan's political life and seen as one of Imran Khan's fiercest defenders. And for her to renounce politics yesterday was seen by Khan supporters who talked to me as really a sign that this crackdown is working, that they are tightening the noose around the former Prime Minister. And I should say that this crackdown is in response to protests that took place on May 9th, and these were unprecedented in Pakistan's tumultuous history. Khan's supporters protested across the country, and they even rampaged and smashed up army installations. And this is a country where the military is not only the Pakistan's most powerful institution, it's revered and feared. So for this to happen, really, I think it stopped collective hearts here. What were they doing and where would this go? Now, these protesters had gone onto the streets because they were reacting to Imran Khan's brief arrest on May 9 by paramilitary forces. But it appears, as far as we can tell, speaking to analysts and commentators, that the army did not anticipate the reaction that Khan supporters would have to his arrest and how much it would be targeted against the military itself.
Clearly a super tense moment in time. Let's walk this back a bit when, I suppose, this particular round of turmoil erupted when Imran Khan was ousted from power. How and why was he removed from power? Doesn't seem to have anything to do with his popularity, shall we say.
Well, yes and no. So it's, you know, delving back into Pakistani politics is sort of like, where do you start? But Imran Khan was the prime minister and he was ousted in April 2022. And that was after the military signalled that it no longer supported his rule. And that's when his coalition basically fell apart. They got the message that the military was no longer supporting this man and they participated in a no-confidence motion against him. And what we can see from then on, basically, since that moment last April, is that this has been a fight between Imran Khan, his party, and Pakistani security forces, particularly the military, about who really controls the hearts and minds of Pakistanis. And the great irony here, as his critics would note, was that Imran Khan, by all intents, from all intents and purposes, appeared to have been propelled or assisted into the prime ministership by the military itself through a process of cracking down on media that was unsympathetic to him and through crackdowns on his opponents. That said, he does have a demographic here that avowedly supports him. They're quite muscular and they were quite loud until this crackdown. And his popularity appears to have only grown since he was ousted. But in fact, in April last year, when he was ousted, he wasn't that popular. He was seen as an erratic leader, that he'd mismanaged the economy, that he was focusing on sort of maligning his enemies more than governance itself. But as it tends to happen in Pakistan, once the army has thrown you out, that's when you start really gaining street credibility.
And he's been building on that, hasn't he? He's done regular addresses on YouTube, on social media platforms, which are viewed by thousands.
It's remarkable. It's remarkable. He hasn't gone quietly at all. And we, you know, analysts, you know, sort of joke that every time, you know, the military closes a door for Imran Khan, he finds a window. He has really leveraged his popularity in a way that I think has surprised Pakistani observers, the degree to which he is willing to engage in a showdown against Pakistan's military establishment. He cuts through on social media. He's extremely popular in the Pakistani diaspora. He appears to have some support within the establishment itself. And the establishment here sort of refers to the Pakistani military and like the amorphous sort of business and retirees around it who Pakistanis here sort of sees the deep state. He seems to command a lot of support from that cohort. And he has money or at least sources of funding that helps him continue. And so it has been remarkable. And it also seems that parts of Pakistan's Supreme Court, appear to be sympathetic to Imran Khan. And so in cases where, you know, he's got these dozens of cases against him, they just seem to pop up out of nowhere. His lawyers are constantly getting what they call omnibus bail. the words I learn reporting here. And so they're seeking bail for cases they know about and for cases they don't know about. And what they say is that these cases are politically motivated, and that may well be true, but some of these cases are also quite serious.
So what exactly are the legal charges against Imran Khan that we know about? Obviously, there's a bunch we don't.
Right. I mean, I would say broadly the key ones are corruption allegations. One is that he is accused of selling gifts given by foreign dignitaries to the Pakistani state and selling them off without registering them. And that is something that many Pakistani leaders and their lackeys have engaged in, but they argue the difference is that Imran Khan didn't register the gifts first. The second quite serious allegation is that he was involved in helping one of Pakistan's most powerful real estate developers bring money back from the UK to Pakistan in exchange for being given land to build a university on. And the third serious case, as far as we can tell, is that he... Imran Khan is accused of having an illegitimate daughter, if we're still using that word in 2023, and he did not list her as one of his offspring on his papers that he filed with Pakistan's Electoral Commission.
Right. And I understand that Pakistan is due to hold elections in the second half of this year. So is that the crescendo that all of this is building to?
It may well be. The government here, which is a broad church coalition of parties largely united in their hatred of Imran Khan, say that elections, federal elections, will happen in October. But the critics of this government say they don't believe them because they've sidestepped holding elections in two provinces, including Pakistan's largest province, Punjab, which has more than 110 million people, so it's no small place. So it's all technically leading up to October, but there's a lot of doubts about whether those elections will actually be held. And that would break something really important that's been happening in Pakistan in the past 15 years, which is that although no prime minister has lasted their full term, there has been a process of one civilian government handing over power to the other, regardless of how flawed and fragile that democracy has been.
Mm. Meanwhile, the country is suffering a severe economic crisis. What does that mean on the ground for ordinary Pakistanis?
For many Pakistani analysts, they would say that right now Pakistan is engulfed in a poly crisis. They're being held hostage by a political drama, a tussle between Imran Khan's party and the Pakistani military. But in the meantime, food prices are soaring beyond belief. We're talking about prices not increasing by 10 or 20%, but at least by 40%. And in some rural areas, they've doubled. So this is a country where malnutrition and wasting has always been a problem, but at this point the United Nations estimates that more than 5.5 million people are facing the spectre of starvation if they don't get help. Many more millions, people we casually speak to, are missing meals, really tightening their belts because they just can't afford food, and it's really hard to see how the economic crisis can be dealt with without the political crisis being resolved first. The problem is one keeps exacerbating the other. And it's not just an economic crisis that Pakistan's facing. This is one of the world's most vulnerable countries to the impacts of climate change. And although Pakistan is an incredibly polluted country, waterways, the air, these sorts of things, as a global contributor, it has a minuscule contribution to planetary warming. And yet its poorest people are facing the brunt of planetary warming, whether that's manifested through extreme floods like what happened last year when at the peak about a third of the country was underwater, or whether it's through extreme drought, which has been happening in parts of Pakistan and in neighbouring Afghanistan. And again, these are issues that really can't be dealt with in any systemic way until the political crisis is somehow resolved. And this is a country that still hasn't even recovered from last year's floods. They really did hit Pakistan's poorest the hardest, and many of them are still homeless, unsheltered, do not have regular access to food, are more likely to be starving or malnourished, and whose children are being denied an education. So it nearly feels like this country of what now nearly 250 million people is being held hostage to this crisis.
Dia, thank you so much for unpacking all that for us. We really appreciate it.
Oh, I hope that was clear somehow. Thank you so much for your time, Sarah.
It was. Thank you. Dia Hadid is NPR's international correspondent covering Pakistan and Afghanistan.
Find more great ABC RN stories that take you beyond the headlines on the ABC Listen app.